Session number 9173, reel 12.
John Redway, tape 12. Could I ask you now about the procedure regarding death sentences? Would you have been involved in any way in this?
Yes, to the extent of offering advice. The system, the procedure was that the governor had to take the advice of the had to seek the advice of the executive council, of which I was a member. But the decision was, of course, entirely his. It was a personal decision. It was the duty, however, of each member of the executive council to give his opinion and advice, and it was rather more naturally in circumstances. It was very formal. Whereas normally in meetings of the executive council there would be a good deal of cross discussion, and I don't mean ill-tempered discussion. I mean across the table, so to speak. Naturally, with this very grave matter, it was done in a formal way, and the governor took the opinion of the deputy governor first and then went round the table taking the opinion of each person. And it was, of course, a very harrowing experience. You had to take the papers from the court and read them very, very carefully, and the night before you were going to give your advice, of course, you had to weigh it up very carefully in your own mind. And the instructions were, I think, that if one felt that there was a particle of uncertainty about the guilt, then one should say so. In fact, as far as I can recall, no one ever dissented from the view which the governors concerned had taken, Harding and Foote. But it certainly, as you can imagine, was a very harrowing experience. Not a job that I liked having to do.
Is there any special case that you remember that you?
Not really. Now, after all this time, no, I don't think so.
Could I now ask you about the issue of partiality regarding the Greek and the Turkish Cypriots? This has cropped up in passing, you know, throughout our interview. Did you find it difficult to remain impartial? You know, was this, or to be seen to be impartial?
Certainly, to be seen to be impartial was virtually impossible, because, as I think I've said before, this is, the Cyprus thing affair was one of those sad disputes where, if you were not for the one side, then you were automatically against it, and vice versa. So, one expected to be accused of partiality and became inured to it. Certainly anyone who in the administration, who in the course of his duty had to take a position against Enesis and the Greek Cypriot position in general, inevitably was accused of being biased, a partisan towards the Turks, and vice versa. But one's job was to try and hold firmly to the middle of the road, and that, I think, is what we all tried to do. I felt, I remember on one occasion, I felt strongly that I must have got it about right, because I opened my a Greek newspaper in the morning to see a headline, Redaway, Enemy of the Greeks, and then my Turkish newspaper and to read Redaway, Enemy of the Turks. So I felt, at least on that day, I'd got it about right.
I wondered if you had any special problem, bearing in mind you had married a Greek Cypriot lady.
I suppose that the Greek Cypriots probably, to begin with anyway, expected that I would be favourable towards their side, but particularly since we had had a very happy and successful period when I was serving as district commissioner in Limassol, and had, I think, become really very popular with the Greek Cypriots and with the Turks as well. We got on extremely well there. And I imagine people were disappointed that I hadn't been able to steer things more in the direction that the Greek Cypriots or the Greek Cypriot leaders wanted. I think it's probable that they believed that, in view of my background and connections and so on, that I must at heart have been sympathetic towards the cause of Ennissus, as nearly all Philhellenes were. And I would like to think that within reason I was Philhellene. So I suppose it added to their disappointment that I wasn't able to do more. I think that during the period of negotiations with Archbishop Makarios, it was probably felt on that side that I was at least taking a balanced sort of view. And later, there may have been some feeling that at least they knew where they were with me because of my long connection to the island and so on, and that somebody replacing me might be even worse. What I did suffer from personally was a campaign of denigration in the local press, and that was particularly stimulated by Charles Foley in his Times of Cyprus. I've got a collection of extracts from his paper somewhere around, and it does show us, give evidence of a sustained campaign to blacken my name and motives and so on. Maybe I deserved it, I don't know. But it seemed very unfair to me at one time, and indeed I was on the point of initiating legal proceedings against him for defamation at one stage, and the Attorney General in Cyprus, Sir James Henry, had although he wasn't advising me personally, he had given the opinion that these were undoubtedly, some of these publications were undoubtedly defamatory, and that I would have a good case, but that I ought to consult my own legal advisers. I discussed it with Hugh Foote, and he said he wouldn't stand in my way, but on the whole, he felt it was might be unwise and possibly not to my own interest, and certainly not in the public interest. So I didn't pursue it. But it was really a disgraceful campaign, including at one point an article which, if I remember rightly, was entitled "Redaway Orders His Coffin," which was seemed to me anyway, to be a pretty clear incitement to Eoka to bump me off.
Was he accusing you of being pro-Turk then?
Being pro-Turk, being anti-Greek, being an obstacle to a peaceful and reasonable settlement.
Would you say yourself that Hugh Foote showed partiality towards the Greek Cypriots?
No, I think that would be quite unfair. His a policy of conciliation naturally appeared to show a disposition to understand, to try and restore confidence and so on with the Greeks, because it was after all with the Greek side that the dispute with Britain had developed. So I think the whole it was inevitable that the policy of conciliation should be looked at that should appear at that stage or be interpreted by some people at that stage as being biased towards the Greeks, and that's certainly how the Turks felt about it. But it was in the nature of the thing. I mean, there was no need for a policy of conciliation towards the Turks at that time, though that did become a problem later on. As far as he was personally concerned, I'm sure that he sought, like all of us, to firmly to hold a balance between the two. Who knows, he may have found the Greeks with their quick wits and their political astuteness and so on easier to attune himself to than the more solid and less forthcoming Turks. That was a matter that every individual had to come to terms with. But I'm quite sure that it would be wrong to charge him with partiality towards the Greeks. He was conscious of this because at one stage early on in his governorship, he did make a public statement that if anybody thought he was favouring the Turks, then the only thing for him to do would have been to get on an aeroplane and go away. So he obviously was conscious of it and wanted to try and reassure Turkish opinion. Of course, one problem that arises, a personal problem with every individual that arises here, is that it's possible one does decide that one side is more in the right than the other. And I don't think that it would be correct to accuse any individual of deciding that in the end enesis, self-determination by majority, was the right course. It was a matter of opinion. I, as it happened, didn't take that view, but I certainly wouldn't denounce anybody for holding that view. As a person, when it comes to conduct as a public official, then obviously it's quite different, and there one had very firmly to try to hold a proper balance between the two sides and not to show partiality to one or the other.
I wonder now, Mr. Redaway, if you'd be good enough to give us more information about the Macmillan Plan. Now, first of all, you have explained how the Tripartite Conference of 1955 really was linked with this, wasn't it? Almost a forerunner, if one likes.
Yes. Well, really, there had for a long time been two strains, or two schools of thought, I think, in British circles. In the crudest terms, the one was that the solution of the problem was to be found locally within Cyprus by way of constitutional government leading in time to self-government and perhaps in time to independence. The other was that this was essentially an international problem, and that the way out of the impasse was to try to bring both Greece and Turkey into the picture. And after all, the root of the problem then anyway appeared to be that the Greeks and Turks of Cyprus strongly believed themselves to be Greeks and Turks, members of the Greek and Turkish nations, and nobody in their senses would ever have disputed that. I mean, they felt themselves to be Greeks and Turks, and so really they were. The consistent British policy up to this time really had been the internal one, the search for an internal solution by development of constitutional government, until the time of the Tripartite Conference in 1955. That really was, we crossed the Rubicon there between insistence on continuing British sovereignty and accepting that this was an international problem which would have to be solved in consultation with Greece and Turkey, and that inevitably they would have to be given some a voice in the final solution. Now, the international school of thought reached back quite a long way. I think it was Leopold Amory who, perhaps in the 1920s or early 1930s, wrote a note about trying to settle the Cyprus problem by recognizing that the people were Greeks and Turks and should be given dual a nationality. And ideas of that kind had been kicking around a long time. The Economist and the Observer had articles in, I think, about 1946 or 48, that kind of period, ventilating the idea of some kind of tripartite solution to the problem. So it wasn't entirely new, but Macmillan had given it the first official blessing in the Tripartite Conference, which, in the terms of the invitation, I'm not sure that I mentioned this, made it quite clear that he was recognising that Greece and Turkey had a legitimate interest in Cyprus. So the Macmillan plan, as it emerged, really was an extension and development of a school of thought that had been there quite a long time. And it was a move in the direction of seeking an international solution rather than an internal one. To some extent, I think people... on the British side, people who were concerned with this problem, their views may have been dictated to some extent by where they were. I have the strong impression, looking back on it, that in Cyprus, we felt that the place to seek a solution of the Cyprus problem was in London, Athens, and Ankara, not in Nicosia, whereas certainly the embassies in Athens and I think in Ankara tended rather strongly to take the opposite view that this difficult problem had better be sorted out within the island in Nicosia. After the collapse of the Foot plan, and, of course, I think ministers in London must take their share of the blame for that, because they ought to have foreseen that the ideas contained in the Foot plan were heading for trouble with Turkey, instead of which they appeared to give him more or less a free hand. Well, after the collapse, Foot cast round for some new initiative. What could we do to get out of the mess? And I recall one evening he asked me to go out and see him privately, and we sat down and talked about it, and he said, well, what in the world are we going to do? What can we turn to now? And so I then explained to him the sort of ideas that had developed towards the end of Harding's governorship, and outlined in a very summary form the kind of arrangements which were eventually embodied in the Macmillan Plan. Rather to my surprise, he took to this enthusiastically and said, yes, yes, that's the way to go. He did have one a point that we ought to give the Greeks a greater say in the governing council of the island. I think I'd suggested 4 Greeks and 2 Turks or something like that, and he thought that there should be a greater proportion of Greeks. No problem as far as I was concerned, provided the governor and the representatives of Greece and Turkey, I'm rather running ahead now, but provided they had the power to prevent discrimination by the Greek Cypriot majority against the Turkish Cypriot minority. Well, then we worked it out in a bit more detail, and he sent off a dispatch to London, and it so happened shortly afterwards that the Prime Minister Macmillan happened to be passing through Cyprus, and Foote went out to see him at the Nicosia airport. And they had a long discussion there while Macmillan was waiting for his plane to go on to London. And Foote came back and told me that it had gone very well, and the Prime Minister seemed to be very favourably disposed to ideas of this kind, and it was now up to us to work it out in more detail. And that is what happened. And so, against the background of deepening crisis in Cyprus because of the intercommunal conflict, behind the scenes, both in Nicosia and in London, we were working on this scheme, which we hoped would be a breakthrough. The details of it were set out in papers at the time and in the statements that Macmillan made in the House of Commons. People who are studying this period really ought to go back and examine carefully the actual texts of what Macmillan had to say, because sometimes they are rather loosely quoted and even misinterpreted. The idea was to forget about self-determination which could possibly lead to enesis and partition for the time being, though quite rightly the Prime Minister did say that, of course, if the new plan failed, then we would have to fall back on other solutions which we all agree would be undesirable. And then he went on to say, and so we would stand by the pledge about self-determination. That seems to me to be a very clear refutation of the Greek Cypriot allegation that partition was really the preferred policy. It was what we were seeking all the time with Turkey, because there the Prime Minister himself had said it was among the other courses which we all agree would be undesirable. So he had to keep it on record as what we would revert to if the new plan failed. The plan provided for associating Greece and Turkey with the government of Cyprus and with the decision on its final status. Greece and Turkey were to be invited to appoint representatives who would sit with the governor and play a part in the actual administration of Cyprus. Originally, it was proposed that they should actually sit in some executive body with the governor, but one of the modifications that Macmillan made after consultation in Athens and Ankara, that is after the announcement of his original plan, was that they would the Greek and Turkish representatives would be associated with the governor, but not actually be incorporated in the governmental system, so to speak. Then there was to be a large degree of self-government by the Cypriots themselves, with only defence and foreign affairs and internal security reserved to the governor.